Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I hope you'll join with us on this program today. We're going to go into the woods, if you will, and talk about mushrooms. And I have with me on the line Langdon Cook. He is the author of The Mushroom Hunters on the Trail of an Underground America. And he's been profiled on the Travel Channel, in Bon Appetit, Whole Living, and Salon.com. And his writing has appeared in numerous magazines and newspapers, including Sunset, Gray's Sporting Journal, and Outside. He's also a columnist for Seattle Magazine and has been the recipient of many grants and awards. And he lives in Seattle with his wife and two children. Langdon, thank you for joining me on the program.
Hi, it's good to be with you, Brian.
Now, I have to admit, it says I love mushrooms, but after reading your book, I'm loving something that I could love a lot more if I really could taste the really good mushrooms. So my first question to you, and coming from Utah, where we tend to be dry and don't get wild access to a lot of mushrooms, how did you first get into this? Because it doesn't strike me as something that you could make a living at doing, but a lot of people are doing it.
Certainly. Well, you know, I'm a writer first, and that's how I make my living. I have not tried to make a living picking mushrooms, although I do try for a little bit in the book. I go up to the Yukon, for instance, and pick morels for a week and see how I do financially. But, you know, I've been foraging for 20 years now, really ever since I moved to Seattle. There's a pretty vibrant wild foods culture here. We can forage 12 months, of the year, and there's a lot to find out in nature. Mushrooms, in particular, they're really sort of the poster boy for wild foods. There's a mystique around them. There's so many different varieties with different colors and textures and taste profiles, and if you only get your mushrooms from the supermarket, you have no idea what you're missing.
So when I'm going into a grocery store here and I'm seeing these white mushrooms and I see portobello and I think, these are going to be really good mushrooms. Would you even call them mushrooms? I mean, technically they're fungi, but with what you have found and in your research and what you've tasted, there's really no comparison.
Well, you know, first of all, those are mushrooms. They're domesticated. And you might be surprised to find out that cremini mushrooms and portobellos are exactly the same species. They're just in sort of different stages of maturity. So, you know, we can take the grocery store button mushroom that's been farmed and give it all sorts of exotic sounding names and make them sound like they've been picked over in Europe and shipped here. But in fact, they're domesticated, and they were actually probably grown in Pennsylvania or somewhere like that, and shipped to market. But you know, the wild mushrooms, they have to be picked by somebody out in the woods. They can't be farmed. We haven't figured out how to do it. They're mysterious, and they have mysterious tastes as well. And so they really are beguiling. And by the way, I should point out that it may be dry in much of Utah, but you do have one particular species of wild mushroom up in your mountains, which many people love going after. And I'm talking about porcini mushrooms. That's what the Italians call them. The king beliefs. They are a widely sought after mushroom all over the world. One of the favorites of connoisseurs, and you can go up into your mountains in summertime, July and August, and find porcini.
Would you try to compare or contrast the different flavors between the mushrooms, the domesticated mushrooms that are grown for sale in stores and those that you have found?
Sure. I think most of us, you know, have a sense of what a grocery store button would taste like. We've had them, you know, in salads and on pizzas. We know that mushroomy flavor. Now, when you start finding the wild species out in nature, you'll be surprised to find out that they have very different flavors. So, for instance, take chanterelles and their cousins. They have aromas of stone fruit. Some chefs will tell you that they're reminiscent of apricots. So they're a little bit on the sweet side, and they actually pair really nicely with, say, a cut of pork for that salty, sweet flavor that people love so much. Or with porcini mushrooms, which I mentioned before, they have almost, when they're fresh, a sort of a nutty flavor. And then when they're dried and used later, they have a powerful aroma that is hard to pin down, but it's earthy and toasty and really kind of exudes just this aroma of the woods. So, you know, mushrooms have all kinds of different flavors. In fact, there's one called the lobster mushroom, which, true to its name, has a somewhat a hint of the sea to it.
So when you're looking at these mushrooms, I mean, the average Joe, he goes out or he or she goes out into the woods and sees a mushroom. And you're not suggesting that we just go ahead and pick anything, because there are poisonous mushrooms.
That's right. And you know, the golden rule of the forager, the rule to hold above all others, is that you never eat anything from the wild without being able to identify it with 100% certainty. So when I'm teaching classes, when I'm taking people out, you know, I tell folks to join a mycological society, take a class, go out with an expert, see these mushrooms in the field, hold them in your hand, look at them from all angles, see them in their habitat. Certainly having, you know, a collection of field guides is fine, but photos don't really tell the whole picture. You really have to go out and see them, you know, in their habitat. That's the best way to learn mushrooms. And actually, you know, some of our best tasting mushrooms are quite easy to identify. I know that people are sort of nervous about that. But once you've studied them a little bit, you can learn their characteristics and go out and find them yourself. Of course, it's also good to know the poisonous varieties. And they're not many, but there are some that you should know, and maybe even learn those before the edible ones.
Well, and so I'm guessing that the best way to learn how to forage is to go out with someone who's experienced at it.
That's right. Find a mentor. Find somebody who can take you out. You know, join a mycological society, take a class, go on a field trip. You know, I think it's just great to get outside, go out and interact with your natural landscape. You know, going out and finding your own food is a wonderful excuse to just be out in nature.
Now, does there tend to be a culture of, like, I really don't want to share. I've got this area where I know that the mushrooms are, and I really don't want to share it. Or can you usually find someone who would mentor you?
Well, that's kind of the big put on. You know, mushroom pickers love to talk about secrecy, their secret patches, and you know, their maps with their little notations and all of that. And it's kind of a big joke among foragers, the secrecy aspect of it. But you know, most of the people that I profile in the book that I tagged along with, they were actually very generous with their knowledge. You'd be surprised at how many people will be willing to share family spots and their special locations. Although, you know, there is an element of secrecy too, and maybe they won't share their best spots. But I think that there's a camaraderie out there, and for me, if I can get more people out into the woods, you know, on our public lands and enjoying the outdoors, then I feel like I've done my job.
We're speaking with Langdon Cook. He's author of The Mushroom Hunters on the Trail of an Underground America. It's published by Ballantine Books. And if you would like to join our conversation, we'd love to have your questions or comments. You can post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, or you can send an email question to zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can call us the old-fashioned way at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. And one of the questions that kind of fascinated me is how specific a mushroom grows to certain areas. For instance, in your book, you talk about Mount Mazama in southern Oregon, and I was just there last month, and the types of fungi that grow there that are almost specific to that area.
Well, that's right. And that's an extinct volcano, which blew its top probably around 7,700 years ago.
Which is fairly recent.
Sort of ash and pumice. all over the place. And it turns out that matsutake mushrooms, which are a favorite in Japan, really like those sandy soils. So the spine of the Cascade Mountains, where I live in the Pacific Northwest, that's a great place to look for matsutake because they like those type of soils. And interestingly, about 90% of those mushrooms get exported to Japan, where they're considered a delicacy. Although more and more people in North America are learning the charms of matsutake, which are really sort of unique mushroom. In fact, there was an article in the New York Times today about them, and the pickers in Oregon who collect in the Central Cascades to pick this mushroom, which is then exported mostly to Japan and China.
What would you call the mushroom trail? I noticed that in your book as well. Why is the Pacific Northwest so good for mushrooms?
Well, it's a famously damp place, as you know. It's fairly temperate. We have, you know, constant storms rolling in off the North Pacific, which bathe us in moisture. And you can pick mushrooms 12 months out of the year on the Mushroom Trail. So imagine the Mushroom Trail sort of extending from Northern California up through Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, into Southeast Alaska, and then ranging eastward to the Yukon and down through Idaho and western Montana and back into California. That's roughly the area that people are talking about when they talk about the Mushroom Trail. And you have these itinerant pickers and buyers who follow it on a year-round basis, following the mushroom flushes as different species fruit up and down the trail. And they will move with the seasons. They will camp in the forest, sometimes in huge encampments, as we have with the matsutake pick going on right now in central Oregon. And they'll pick the mushrooms by day and then haul them out of the woods and sell them to a buyer who's set up near the mushroom patches. It might just be a little wall tent with a cook stove in there to keep warm, and a table, fold-out table with some scales. And they'll weigh the mushrooms and pay out whatever the price is that they're paying that day. And the prices fluctuate sometimes even on an hourly basis, depending on what the competition is doing. I mean, it's a very global trade. In fact, I went to China two summers ago and was amazed to find that the mushroom camps out in the wilderness there resemble very closely the mushroom camps in Oregon and Washington. So that's the Mushroom Trail. It's also kind of a metaphor in my book. You know, people who are drawn to the Mushroom Trail tend to be the sorts who they live a little bit on the edge. They're looking for some adventure. They don't want to have a boss looking over their shoulder. They want to be out in the woods on their own, you know, wandering around looking for mushrooms. And there's that sort of gold rush mentality that the mother lode might be over the next ridge. There's really a very American optimism behind it, that, you know, there might be a great flush happening. If we just get to this place and find where the mushrooms are, we could make a bunch of money. And, you know, rarely does that happen, but occasionally it does. And so, you know, it's both a physical area, a geographical area, and a sort of more of a spiritual sensibility, the Mushroom Trail.
Why don't you talk about one of your experiences of hitting a gold rush and what that's like? And I know you said you're an author, but you kind of get into this. You feel it the way that the forager is feeling it, and you're part of the experience.
Sure. One of the characters that I profile in the book is Jeremy Faber, who's the owner of Foraged and Found Edibles, which is a wild food purveyor based out of Seattle. And he has also a New York hub. And he ships his products all over the world, and wild mushrooms are a big part of that. So in the book, I have a chapter about going to the Yukon with Jeremy. I was at home, and I'd been sort of following the morel mushroom flush as it proceeded from sort of the eastern slope of the Sierras up up through Oregon and into Washington, and I was keeping in touch with Jeremy by phone and text, and just sort of, he was keeping me apprised of how the season was going, and it wasn't going very well. And so finally I get this call from him in June, and he says, I'm going to UConn. Do you want to go with me? And I had to think about it for a second, and then, yep, I do. I want to go up there and see what's going on. So we flew up to Whitehorse and drove 5 hours into the Yukon bush, and there had been a fire. And we have this phenomenon in the West where after forest fires, the spring following the fire can produce a huge morel flush in the mountains. And this is what had happened up there. There had been a forest fire, big fire, and the following spring the morels started popping. And he needed a big infusion for his business. So we set up camp for a week. He was there for a month. I tagged along for a week. But we were out there in the Yukon bush every day getting up. It's the land of the midnight sun, of course. So we were getting up, you know, 5 a.m. and heading off into the woods to go pick mushrooms. And doing that for maybe 18 hours during the day. And then at the end of the day, which was, you know, 8, 9, 10 o'clock in the evening, the pickers would emerge from the woods with maybe 100 pounds of morels, and sell them to Jeremy. And so, you know, between buying mushrooms and then picking during the day, he was filling up his truck and driving every other day to Whitehorse to ship his mushrooms down to Seattle, where they could then be dispersed throughout the country. It was really pretty amazing out there in the bush. And of course, you're thinking about grizzly bears and the possibility of getting lost. And the insects were unbelievable. They never let up. All kinds of different biting flies. And that's just part of it. You're out there in the wild. You know, you have to be able to take care of yourself.
So did he was up there for a month. Were there mushrooms the whole time, or he's just setting up shop, kind of staking out the territory?
Well, no, there were mushrooms flushing the whole time, and that's because when you have these burns, there's a succession of different species of morels that will continue to flush, and you just need to know how to find them. And he could have been there longer than a month. He could have been there a couple of months. These are some of the things that I was learning. I mean, most people around the country figure that they might be able to pick morels for a week or two. And in fact, in the Midwest, where morel hunting is very popular recreationally, that's true. But out here in the West, where we have topography, you can start, you know, you can move up through the mountains and pick these species over a long period of time. Of course, if you're moving around between, say, you know, Oregon and the Yukon, then, you know, you can hit the flushes at different times. So a lot of these mushrooms are available for longer periods of time than most people realize.
How would you say that the foraging culture has changed in the last 20 years?
Well, you know, it's really still in its infancy when you think about it. I mean, this culture didn't exist much more than 30 years ago in terms of the commercial culture. Wild mushrooms became kind of a big part of the restaurant scene in the U.S. starting about the mid-1980s. And so that's really when this commercial culture began. Before that, you know, there might be a guy who would go pick some mushrooms and show up at the back door of a restaurant and try and sell them. But really not until the mid-80s, late 80s, did it get organized in any sort of fashion. So we're dealing with a fairly new industry, and I think what's happening at this point is more people are tuning into it. You know, as we learn more about the food on our plate, where it comes from, whether it's good for us or not, you know, nutritional issues, real food issues, people are interested in these wild foods. They have interesting flavors. They have, you know, nutritional benefits that you can't necessarily get from domesticated varieties. And I'm not talking about just mushrooms. I'm talking about huckleberries and wild greens, all sorts of things.
You're listening to the Zesty Garden, and we're interviewing Langdon Cook. He's the author of The Mushroom Hunters on the Trail of an Underground America. It's printed by Ballantine Books. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also post a comment or question to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. And then you can also send us an email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. There's kind of this, I guess what you would call an underground economy of the wild mushroom harvesters, and you've been out with this. It's pretty much an all cash business.
That's right. Yeah, I mean it's really sort of a shadowy world, and that's what intrigued me. I remember for my first book, Fat of the Land, which is a collection of essays about wild foods. I have a chapter on morel mushrooms, and I was out in the woods of northern Washington in the North Cascades Mountains, right near the Canadian border, home to grizzlies and wolves and all kinds of wildlife. And I was with a friend, and we started hearing these strange noises in the woods. And what was unnerving about it was that we realized these were human noises. Well, it turned out they were mushroom pickers who were communicating with each other across a sort of vast expanse of woods. And eventually we ran into them. And they had these, they were dwarfed by these huge packs that they were carrying. And here we were with our little mushroom baskets, and we each had maybe 5 pounds of mushrooms. And these guys each had maybe 80 pounds of morels on their backs. And I remember just kind of looking at them, wondering, how can you do that? How can you walk into untrailed woods and find this sort of quantity of a food that most people will spend their entire lives, you know, the recreational hunters, trying to unravel the secrets of these mushrooms. And here they are, picking just unfathomable quantities. And they looked at us, and we looked at them, and there was not a word exchanged. And then they just turned on their heels and disappeared back into the timber. And that was several years ago, and that's when I realized I really want to write about these guys, because there was just so little known about this subculture. It's really a hidden economy.
What about, and I hadn't even thought about this because I'm a law-abiding citizen. I would never take anything from a national park, but there are those foragers who go into, like, say, the Olympic Peninsula, also Mount Rainier National Park. You had a couple of stories in there about what that's like, collecting mushrooms under the guise of if you get caught,
illegally,
you're thrown in jail.
Right. Yeah, there is some of that. You know, the most of the pickers are law-abiding citizens. But the thing is that the regulatory apparatus is really just catching up with wild mushroom pickers and foragers in general. So the land managers of our state and national forests and parks are really just starting to figure out that they have all these foods that are sought after within their jurisdictions. And so right now we're dealing with sort of a crazy quilt pattern of regulations, because you can be picking mushrooms, say in a national forest somewhere, and then just over the border, you know, in an adjacent national forest, or maybe in a national park, or maybe in a state park, the regulations are totally different. Now, of course, it's up to the forager to know what the regulations are. But sometimes not even the rangers know what's going on in terms of the regulations for foraging within their own jurisdictions. So, you know, there's a little bit of catch-up ball being played right now as everyone tries to figure out, you know, what the best approach is. Now, the thing about mushrooms is that as far as we can tell, picking mushrooms does no harm to the organism itself. So it appears to be a very sustainable activity. In other words, the fungus that produces the mushroom, which is simply the fruiting reproductive body of the fungus, it will produce that mushroom year after year. And we can pick it, and that's fine. What will harm that fungus is, say, cutting down the woods, paving them over, developing them, polluting them. Those are the things that will harm the production of the mushrooms.
When you pick
picking them, not so much.
So when you pick them, are you actually distributing the spores?
Some people think so. So you'll see mushroom pickers out there with buckets that have all sorts of holes drilled into them so that the spores can fall through the bucket. And they're like, you know, Johnny Appleseeds of the mushroom world spreading the spores. I have a feeling that the mushrooms are doing just fine on their own without our help. But lots of pickers do like to try and, give them an extra hand there.
We have a question from a caller in southern Utah. Bettina in Springdale is on the line. Hi, Bettina.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How can we help?
Well, I had heard about a TED Talk by a mushroom guy, and he was talking about declaring our national forest as part of the defense because of the ability of mushrooms to kind of transmute pollution. Are you familiar with this fellow?
You know, I touched on this. I think you might be talking about Paul Stamets.
Yeah.
Who has given a very interesting TED Talk, which he calls How Mushrooms Can Save the World. And, you know, it's a tribute to the otherness of fungi, you know, the kingdom that we know much less about than, say, the plant or animal kingdoms. And we are only just starting to discover some of their many secrets. But, for instance, we found out that oyster mushrooms can help clean up oil spills. And we've also seen that mushrooms were very effective at scrubbing nuclear waste contamination from the soil after the Chernobyl incident. So mushrooms do have all sorts of benefits that we're only just starting to figure out. And we're also looking into their anti-cancer properties. So mycologists have a lot of studying to do here, and mycology is it's really getting kind of a boost in recent years as we start to figure out some of these new properties that mushrooms have.
Well, I think he mentioned something about the spores being some of the first life forms on Earth.
Yeah, I'm not exactly familiar with that. In my book, I do get into some of the science, but primarily my interest is in the people who are fascinated by fungi, and fungi is food as well. They're culinary attributes, and certainly they have all sorts of useful attributes. But it's as table fare that most people through the centuries have gotten to know fungi. And that's really where my interest lies.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Bettina. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have a few minutes left. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can email us a question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post a comment or a question. I'm talking with Langdon Cook. He's author of The Mushroom Hunters on the Trail of an Underground America, published by Ballantine Books. And I wanted to talk about, you alluded a little bit early on about the types of people. You see a lot of itinerant workers, the refugee camps, a lot of seasonal encampments. And then you also mentioned in the book a lot of Southeast Asian refugees have been coming into the foraging market, and they're also now beginning to participate.
That's right. And this really coincides with the beginning phase of the wild mushroom industry in this country in the mid-80s. And we also had all sorts of refugees from the wars in Southeast Asia settling here. And if you can imagine, you're suddenly here in the U.S., you don't speak the language, you might not have a lot of marketable skills, but you're comfortable in the woods, and in fact, maybe in your old country, you had to survive to a certain degree by foraging in the woods. So you suddenly had this population of willing folks who could head off into the woods and pick mushrooms, and really do it as family units. You see that time and again. So, you know, the parents might be out foraging the mushrooms. The grandparents are at home kind of dusting them off, cleaning them, getting them ready for the buyer, and the kids are doing some heavy lifting. And I got to know a number of these folks, and it was just amazing to be able to walk into the garage or basement of one of these families, you know, here in this country, maybe just for the last 10 years, and there was 1,000 pounds of golden chanterelles staring at me. You know, it's hard work. It's stoop labor. You know, at this time of year, I can tell you right now, the price for chanterelles is probably around $1.50, maybe $2. So, you know, that 1,000 pounds of mushrooms that they spent the week gathering is worth a couple $1,000s, and that's a lot of money. You know, it can be a way to make a living when you can't do anything else. So there is that influence there. And more recently, I would say we've been seeing more Latinos on the mushroom trail, you know, from the migrant trail up from Mexico. And, you know, you can imagine that you're spending all day, say, in a strawberry patch, stooped over, you know, for minimum wage. Well, walking the woods with the possibility of hitting the mother lode for some seems like a more attractive way to spend the day. So that's kind of the most recent iteration in this process.
Do you see much in the way of violence creeping into foraging as more people learn how to do it and try to stake out areas or run into others who have a large business doing this?
I haven't personally run into a lot of that. I've heard stories. In the mid-90s, there were quite a few newspaper stories on that topic. That happened to be a time when matsutake mushrooms in particular were fetching very high prices, and you heard stories of very territorial pickers and running gun battles through the woods. And in fact, I even talked to a picker who tells me a couple of stories that are in the book of that nature. First-hand stories that he experienced himself. I personally haven't, and I don't think that there are nearly as many gun-packing mushroom pickers as maybe we've been led to believe. It's been kind of a big sensational story. But for the most part, you're just talking about folks who are trying to earn a living, and so... No. I would say that it's been exaggerated. Now, you do run into unsavory characters sometimes in the unpoliced corners, remote, you know, far-flung areas within the national forest. And there are a few stories that I relate in the book where I ran into some people I would have rather not seen. But they were not mushroom pickers, as it turned out.
Why don't you leave us with your favorite story?
My favorite story from the mushroom trail, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I went all over the place to write this book, and I spent several years. I went to New York City. I followed the mushrooms from patch to plate. You know, at one point, I was in Montana with one of my characters. And, you know, for me, a lot of this is just about being out in the hinterlands, reconnecting with the natural world, being outside, and that's what I try and convey to a large degree here. I mean, picking wild foods is a chance to get outside. It's a chance to kind of reconnect with the natural world, and that's one of the things that I hope people take away from this, that it's really just a great way to get out. So not really a story there, but I was, you know, I've been all over, you know, some of the more beautiful and scenic parts of this country picking mushrooms. And I have to say, it's been a great way to just get out there and see see our wilder corners.
One of the things I appreciated about how you wrote this book was how you do get into the lives of the people who are out there foraging. And you get a feeling when you're reading the book that, hey, you're getting to know these people, especially the ones that you get to spend a lot of time with. So I recommend The Mushroom Hunters on the Trail of an Underground America by Langdon Cook from Ballantine Books. Langdon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and we'll be back in just a little bit with a little bit more of the program until the top of the hour.
Good morning. This is Nancy Williams, here for Petals and Prose. And I want to read to you today from a wonderful book about country life and beekeeping by Sue Hubbell. The book is called A Country Year. When her 30-year marriage broke up, Sue Hubbell found herself alone and broke on a small Ozarks farm. Keeping bees, she found solace in the natural world. She began to write, challenging herself to tell the absolute truth about her life and the things that she cared about. The result is one of the best-loved books ever written about life on the land, about a woman finding her way in middle age. Hubbell's book, A Country Year, Living the Questions, is one of my favorites. Organized by season, beginning with spring, her essays about life run the gamut from frogs, dogs, snakes, and eccentric family members to bats, birds, chiggers, and bees. And they're often very funny as she weaves her tales into a tapestry of country life. Listen as she explains her work as a commercial beekeeper in Missouri. My 300 hives of bees are scattered across the hills of southern Missouri in outyards on farmers' pastures or at the edge of their woodlots. I give each family who has one of those outyards a gallon of honey a year as rent. But mostly farmers just like having the hives around, for the bees pollinate their fruit and vegetables and the clover in their pastures. Bees fly 2 miles or more as they forage for nectar. I once calculated that the 18 million bees in my hives cover 1,000 square miles of the Ozarks in their flight. In the spring, I spend most of my time driving to the outyards, taking care of the bees and getting them ready for the major nectar flows from which they will make the honey crop. I use a big truck to haul the honey to market, but for the work around here, I drive a courageous 1954 red Chevy half-ton pickup named Press On Regardless, because it runs zestfully without many parts that are normally considered to be automotive necessities. That pickup and I have been over some rough spots, through mud and hard times, and I like to take good care of it. Today was cold and rainy, not good weather for bee work, so I spent the day working on the pickup. I went out to the center part of the barn where I keep it, made a fire in the wood stove, and turned the radio on to the public station I can get from the university 80 miles to the north. The radio promised that it would give me Albinoni's Concerto in C for 2 oboes and strings. I started checking the pickup's vital fluids. The transmission oil was okay, but I had to add half a can of brake fluid to the master cylinder. I let out the crankcase oil as it was time to change it. While the oil was draining, I jacked up the front of the pickup, rolled under it on my creeper, and with bits of caked mud and grease falling into my eyes, I greased the front end. While lying there on the creeper, Albinoni drifting through my brain, I noticed I had been careless with the right rear shock absorber. Not only was it missing, but the bracket that held it in place had ripped loose. I added 5 quarts of new oil to the crankcase, reversed the truck, checked the oil level in the rear end, and then jacked it up to grease the rear springs. Afterwards, I replaced the starter button above the starter assembly. The foot starter has been balky recently, and Erman, my neighbor, a mechanic who lives across the hollow, had told me that the button needed replacing and showed me how to do it. The old one came out easily enough, but screwing in the new one with my fingertips backed up against the engine block while I sprawled over the fender was hard and took me past Albinoni, through Mozart, Beethoven, and right on up to the Romantics before I was done. After I was finished, I peeled off my greasy coveralls, pleased and mildly surprised, as I always am, to find myself clean enough underneath to receive company in the parlor. There's some mighty fine agility in Hubble's leaps as she stitches honeybees to truck repairs and then to classical music. My dear friend Rosalie Mugler gave me this book 20 years ago, and I fell in love with it immediately. But now that I've become a beekeeper myself, I find that it's even more delightful. One of my favorite chapters in A Country Year is ostensibly about her wedding anniversary, the date when she married the man from whom she was divorced, who prompted her adventures as a solo beekeeper. It's really a collection of anecdotes about grandparents and aunts whose character shaped her life. Book ended by references to her ex-husband, Paul. Here is a snippet. Today is my wedding anniversary. I'm sad when I think of Paul and remember what expectations we had the day we were married, but those failed expectations are what made me a beekeeper in the Ozarks. I like that a lot, and none of it would have happened without Paul. My grandfather was a beekeeper in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where I grew up. But everyone's grandfather was a beekeeper, so that doesn't signify. Besides, my grandfather frightened me. He terrified everyone within shouting distance, and I tried to stay out of his way, so I picked up no love of beekeeping from him. He was a stern man who always wore three heavy layers of clothing, starting, it was reported, with a woolen union suit. He claimed that all the layers kept heat out during the summer and in during the winter. Grandpa liked to winter his bees in the basement, and in the autumn he would imperiously order my father to carry them down there single-handed, despite the danger of hernia. Grandpa couldn't help, because he was subject to terrible racking pains, caused, the doctor tried to tell him, by the binding of the union suit. When Paul and I first started keeping bees and reading about beekeeping, I discovered that overwintering bees indoors is an old-fashioned practice now discredited. So much for the grandfatherly example. Sue Hubble's life before beekeeping was 180 degrees different. She grew up, became a librarian at Brown University in Rhode Island, married and birthed a son, and enjoyed the quiet academic life. Her husband, Paul, was teaching at another university, where he did, she writes, important research, attended meetings, and was a popular lecturer. He had been awarded tenure, that cachet of academic stability and ease, but he was not easy. In fact, he was often distinctly uneasy. When that uneasiness became unbearable, she continues, we quit our jobs and sold our house. We left Rhode Island and wandered around the country for nearly a year until we came to the Ozarks. I liked this farm the instant I saw it, and Paul said he did too, so we bought it. We had to find something to do to make a living, and Paul said that since we didn't know anything about cows, we might as well become beekeepers. At that time, it seemed perfectly reasonable. As it turned out, I was luckier than he, for here I found what I wanted. Today, on our wedding anniversary, I think of him and hope that he has too. So I think, since it is in honor of their anniversary, that we should have a recipe today for something that takes honey, since she's a beekeeper, and is fancy because it's a party. So I found a wonderful recipe for honey chocolate pie, which is from an out-of-print cookbook called The Pooh Cookbook, inspired by the house at Pooh Corner. It's by Virginia Ellison, and it's got the original Ernest H. Shepherd illustrations with the recipes. And this is a simple thing, really, called honey chocolate pie. I'll give you the ingredients, and then you can pick up the detailed instructions from our website, the Zesty Garden part of upr.org. So here we go. Honey chocolate pie. Preheat your oven to 375. You need 1 9-inch pie shell uncooked. You can use a frozen one or one that you buy in the store or make your own. 4 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate. 1/4 cup of butter. 1 14-ounce can of evaporated milk, 1/2 cup of honey, 1 cup of sugar, 3 tablespoons of cornstarch, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 2 large eggs beaten, and 1/2 cup of whipping cream. Here are the instructions. Buy a ready-made pie shell or make your own from any standard recipe or any pie crust mix. Line the pie pan with the pastry before starting on the honey chocolate mixture. Melt the chocolate and butter in the top of a double boiler. When melted, remove it from the heat and blend in the evaporated milk, stirring all the time. I use a whisk for that. In a mixing bowl, blend together the honey, sugar, cornstarch, and salt. Beat in the eggs. Add this mixture to the chocolate mixture slowly, beating all the time. Pour this filling into the waiting pie shell. Bake the pie uncovered for 40 minutes. Then cover it lightly with aluminum foil and bake it 20 minutes more until the top is puffed. Cracks will sometimes show up in the center. Cool it for an hour, then refrigerate it. Serve it cold with whipped cream piled on it. And best of all, dribble a thin trickle of honey beads over the whipped cream. This is very rich and sweet, so bake it when you'll be having several friends in for lunch or supper or a dessert party or your wedding anniversary. It is delicious, and you can celebrate Sue Hubble's wedding anniversary and her bees, as I will be doing too. This is Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden. See you next time.